Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My co-host, Caroline Kilborn, is not with us today because she has some other family events. As you know, if you've listened to this much, Caroline's my mother, and she's with my brother and niece right now. So I'm flying solo. But I have a really interesting book to bring to you today, so I don't think I'm going to run out of things to say without Mom here. Our guest today is Ed Recker. Did I pronounce that right, Ed?
Yes, you did. All
right.
Good morning.
Good morning. And the title of the book is Justice Makes a Killing, and I believe this is book two in the series, the Bobby Earle series.
That's right.
For decades, Ed was one of our most prominent criminal defense lawyers until his retirement. And during his career, he represented numerous high-profile clients, including John Orr, the greatest serial arsonist in American history, and he's been written about quite a bit. And Eddie Nash, a prominent nightclub owner who was portrayed in the film Boogie Nights, and William Harris, a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army who kidnapped Patty Hearst. His Bobby Earle novels have been praised for their authenticity as well as gripping suspense, and I can attest to that. And Justice Makes a Killing was just released in July 2019 from Chickadee Prince Books. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ed.
Well, thank you, Monica.
So did you always want to be a writer while you were doing all this high-profile defense work, or was it something that the idea came along later in life?
No, it's something I always wanted to do. When I first started my career, like many criminal defense lawyers, I joined the Public Defender's Office in Los Angeles to sort of learn the craft. And while there, I was sort of promoted to an administrative position, which allowed me the evenings not to worry about my cases, but to write. I wrote a legal thriller way, way back. It had an agent in New York and was sent off to a top publishing company that liked the book. But wanted to change the ending, and then I went into private practice, and private practice absorbed me so much that I thought, well, this sounds pretty easy. I'll get back to it later. and it took me my entire career to find the time to try and really do it.
So as you were approaching retirement, was it something you were, like, really looking forward to so you'd have time to write?
Absolutely. There's a real sense of satisfaction of trying to craft a good sentence, a good paragraph, and most of all, to tell a interesting story.
And you have a little more control over the ending than you do as a criminal defense court attorney.
Yeah. Well, trying a case before a jury is much like telling a story. The defense has their version of the facts that they weave into a story, and the prosecution takes the same facts and weaves it into a far different story. So I've actually been telling these types of stories my whole career, but now I've got to try and put it on the page and make it interesting enough to leap off the page to a reader.
Now, in Justice Makes a Killing, you're taking on the private prison system. They're sort of one of the enemies, one of the villains in the book. Is this something that is a cause that you are, you know, that is dear to you outside of your writing?
Well, when I've been writing, I find it much more interesting for the reader to try and weave into the story some of the social issues that arise in the criminal justice system. In the first book, The Inevitable Witness, I took on to weave in the professional informants that the prosecutors often use in their cases. And in this legal thriller, in addition to the facts and the story of the case itself, I thought it would be interesting to deal with the private prison industry and the California Prison Guards Union. The sort of the key that set me off in this way was I was approached by a family whose son had been sentenced to prison. I didn't represent him. And they shipped him off to Mississippi, where the family couldn't visit him and he wouldn't have any of the sort of support group once he was released from prison, and found that the lawyers and the judges have no control over that. The corrections department decides to do that. So I wove it into this story where a woman, a very prominent lawyer in Los Angeles, a partner in a powerful law firm, is the spokesperson for an initiative to abolish the use of private prisons in California. She is charged with a double murder arising from the alleged assistance she gave to an inmate at a private prison to help him escape, and the attempted escape results in the death of a prison guard and the inmate himself. So in preparing the defense for his client, Bobby Earle finds these shadowy forces that are working behind the scenes, the private prison industry and the California Prison Guards Union. So I thought it made a good story and something that people might be interested in addition to the real story of the case itself.
Oh, definitely. Now, in the book, it says that in California there was some court ruling about prison overcrowding, and that was why the private prisons were able to get a foothold there, because the taxpayers weren't wanting to build new prisons. And instead of maybe looking at reducing sentences, they decided to let people make money off of imprisoning people. Is that what really happened?
Yes, there's a symbiotic relationship between the prison guards union and the private prison industry. The prison guards union started the national campaign to increase the length of sentences for convicted felons. They were the sponsor of the original three strikes law in California, and that is a fact. In fact, the Supreme Court Justice Kennedy, who's recently resigned and retired, said that in a speech at Pepperdine Law School, that the Prison Guards Union is the sponsor of the three strikes law in California. And he said, quote, "It's sick." So the longer the prison sentences, the more people you end up with in prison, because when new convicted inmates arrive, the previous group of inmates is still serving their time. So ended up with such overcrowded prisons that the U.S. Supreme Court declared it was unconstitutional punishment to cram all these guys together. So the result was not to build more prisons, because thanks to the Prison Guards Union, we went from 10 prisons in a matter of a couple decades to 32 prisons. And so they solved the problem of overcrowding by contracting with private prisons who run the they build a prison and run it on a for-profit basis. The state contracts with the private prison to house the inmates. They're paid on a per day per diem for the inmate, so it's like a hotel. And since it's for profit, anything extra, such as drug treatments, any type of rehabilitation, education, even health, is really not provided to these inmates.
Which I know that here in Iowa, there's great limitations to what's provided to inmates, even though we don't have the private prison system. In our state prison system, the educational opportunities have pretty much been wiped out in recent decades. And it's up to an inmate to pay for, if they want to try and use their time to get an education. There's some correspondence, some colleges that will do things by correspondence, but they're expensive. And most inmates can't afford it.
It's very short-sighted.
Yeah, it is.
It's very short-sighted. We would save a lot more money if we would prepare these guys to have a job, support themselves, become a contributing member of society, rather than put them in prison. And currently in California, the cost of housing an inmate for 1 year, according to the Department of Corrections in California, is $70,000. You could send a child to Harvard for less money than that. So it's just dollars and cents. We could do a lot better.
When I hear those statistics, it just blows my mind, because how can it possibly cost that much? You know, people are making a ton of money off of this.
Well, thanks to the Prison Guards Union, they are the most powerful lobbying force in California. They pay dues to the union. The union uses those dues to heavily contribute to politicians' campaigns, the same politicians who set their salaries. And currently, a prison guard who has graduated from high school earns more with the ordinary overtime that they all arrange to have, more than a assistant professor at the University of California. They can make up to $100,000 a year. And there are like 36,000 prison guards in California.
Is the prison guard unions also contributing to campaigns for district attorneys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, most judges are former prosecutors, because the culture around getting tough on crime has led the public to believe that only prosecutors would really be a judge that would have the public's interest in mind. Mm. So it's sort of a wheel of self-serving.
Yeah, kind of incestuous almost.
Yeah, and I thought it would make an interest in the book. When Bobby Earle first encounters his client, Kate Carlson, the prominent lawyer in Los Angeles, the physical evidence against her is almost overwhelming. And as he is shocked to learn, she says she's been framed. And as he starts to investigate the case, he slowly comes to a conclusion that he didn't want to have, that any criminal defense lawyer doesn't want to have, and that is his client's innocent.
you don't want to think that your client's innocent?
Well, it puts an awful lot of
pressure. Yeah.
On because the defense lawyer is the only one responsible for proving that. And so as he investigates it, these two shadowy forces, the private prisons and the prison guards union, are behind the scenes putting his career in danger, ultimately his life in danger, and the story culminates in a full jury trial, which the reader can experience an authentic view of what a trial is, because a high-profile murder trial has all the drama that a good story should have. It's not like Law and Order. It's a real trial, and I've tried to depict a authentic criminal defense lawyer in the form of Bobby Earle rather than the sort of cardboard characters that appear on television, where the criminal defense lawyer is merely an extension of the criminal enterprise that he's defending. So a full jury trial with a cross-examination of witnesses is really high drama, and hopefully I've been able to capture it on the page.
So, Ed, do you worry at all about, you know, bringing this attention to the prison guards union and that they might come after you?
Oh, they are so powerful. The private prisons are a $1 billion industry. They have prisons in almost every single state. They have private prisons internationally in many countries. So I think they're in their boardrooms. I don't think my name will be come up as a threat to their profit margin. And the California Prison Guards Union, as I said, are literally the most powerful lobbying force in California politics. They're so powerful that they demanded and received that any private prison in California has to have a union guard hired by them. Now, the private prisons don't want to do that because they pay their guards very little. But they got it.
Wow. So the guards and the prisons aren't always necessarily on the same side of things.
Well, the union sort of runs the prison system. They have contracts that specify so many regulations and rules that apply to their union members that they, in essence, set the whole atmosphere of the private prison and how the inmates are treated. So they're not worried about me.
At least you hope not. But what if your book hits number one on the New York Times bestseller list and everyone's talking about it? You might ruffle some feathers.
Well, I seriously doubt the private prison industry or the California Prison Guards Union would be upset enough to do something like that. Besides, the facts in the book are correct. In order to maintain a sense of authenticity, I've been quite careful to only cite the real facts surrounding both of them.
Well, are there any journalists that are trying to call attention to this?
There are articles in the newspapers concerning private prisons. There was a legislative effort to abolish private prisons in California, but they were able to defeat it. So it is a social issue. That's one of the reasons I wanted to include it in the book, because it's something people should be concerned about. This is our criminal justice system, and it shouldn't be something that people make a profit off of. And it's also another tangent in the story of the book is that the private prisons are most interested in housing immigrants who have crossed the border seeking asylum. That's where the big money is for them, because 3 out of every 4 immigrants incarcerated in the United States are incarcerated in a private prison. And our taxpayers pay millions and millions of dollars to those corporations. So it's something we should be concerned about, and I thought it was something that would be interesting to weave into the story in a realistic way, not some fabrication. They are big and they are powerful.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ed Rucker, author of Justice Makes a Killing, which is a legal thriller, and the hero is defense lawyer Bobby Earle. Now, Ed, is Bobby based on anyone in particular?
He's sort of an accumulation of the traits of many criminal defense lawyers I've known. He's a brilliant trial lawyer who's absorbed in defending his clients, which makes it difficult for him to have a meaningful relationship with his girlfriend, Sam, who is a district attorney in Los Angeles. The pressure of trials, which is enormous when you're trying serious cases, sleepless nights, it's just a grip on your concentration. It's difficult to think of other things when you're in the midst of a trial like that. So there's this tension between trying to have a life outside of his cases, as well as the tension of being in a relationship with a prosecutor, because the relationships today between prosecutors and defense lawyers have sort of morphed into much more than just a professional rivalry in court. It's very tribal. When I first started to practice, there was much more of a congenial relationship. Cases were tried very hard. There was a lot of tension in the courtroom, but once the case was concluded, you could go out and have a drink with a prosecutor and laugh about which of you had got the best of the other. But today there's sort of an attitude such as portrayed in much television articles that the defense lawyers are not someone to be respected by the prosecutors, that they're somehow doing a job that doesn't uphold the constitutional balance between the state and individual citizens. So by her having a relationship with Bobby Earle, Sam's colleagues won't trust her as much. They think that somehow she may be sharing information with him and things of that nature, which makes it a very, very difficult thing for her.
I feel like in the past there was even, you know, prosecutors would leave the prosecutor's office and join the become defense attorney sometimes, or maybe the other way around.
Sure.
But
sure.
Not so much anymore.
Now they join the prosecutor's office and they're become career prosecutors, work to be elevated to the bench and become judges. Most of our judges are former prosecutors.
So, you know, in the current Democratic primary race, I've happened to like many of the candidates, but I like Kamala Harris as one of the ones, and she gets some flack for being a former prosecutor.
Well, I think it was less criticism of the role of a prosecutor as some of the positions she took here in California on the death penalty and the release of evidence in cases where someone seems to have been convicted who might have been innocent. And so things about how she performed her role rather than just the fact that she was a prosecutor. That's generally something that's...
Now, did you ever go up against her?
No, she was the attorney general, which rarely has a criminal prosecution, and she was never a trial lawyer in the office that I'm aware of. She was the district attorney of, I think, San Francisco to start. These are all administrative type positions.
Okay. Now, when I was reading your bio, and it mentioned that you represented William Harris, a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, just last night I was watching an old episode. I've been watching the old 3 seasons of Veronica Mars because they have a new season now, you know, 15 years later however many years that I wanted to watch. So I had never watched the old ones, and that's a detective. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's basically a girl detective in California. And Patty Hearst was actually on the show last night. Playing an heiress who with a social conscience.
Yeah.
So I thought that was funny. That's so interesting.
Yeah, and it... one of the themes in the first book, The Inevitable Witness, is the effect of publicity on how the participants in the justice system react. And the Symbionese Liberation Army case had huge publicity around it, and it affects how the lawyers present themselves in court and how the judge is under pressure and the prosecutor is under certain pressure. So publicity is also a factor, and I thought it was something that might be interesting to explore in the first book.
Well, Ed, why don't you read a little bit from Justice Makes a Killing?
Sure. Why don't I read the opening? California Highway Patrol officer Randy Phillips had been following the red Jaguar for the last 20 minutes, making sure to stay a safe half mile back. Under his Kevlar vest, the t-shirt was stuck to his back with sweat. "Christ," he mumbled to himself, "where are they?" He reached down to give his holster a reassuring tug, then nervously fingered the lock mechanism on his pistol's hammer. Keeping the Jaguar in sight was easy. Highway 5 ran ruler straight across the scrub-brush desert towards Los Angeles, 2 hours away, and the asphalt lanes ahead were empty under the blistering afternoon sun. But this waiting had his gut in a knot. He clamped his eyes shut for a moment to ease the tension. When he opened them, sweat stung his eyes. "Come on, come on," he whispered. "Let's do this." Suddenly his radio squawked. "Car 259, we have visual." He bent forward to look up into the cloudless sky. A black and white helicopter was above, keeping pace with the Jaguar like a kite being pulled on a string. He stomped on the accelerator. The big cruiser quickly closed the distance and roared up within inches of the Jaguar, red lights flashing, sirens shrieking. The Jaguar slowed immediately and rolled to a stop on the gravel shoulder. There was no movement inside. The cruiser halted a curious 10 yards back. The helicopter swooped down and hovered loudly just above, kicking up a swirling cloud of sand and dust around the cars. The cruiser's door flew open, and Officer Phillips rolled out to crouch behind it. His breath came in short pants. He gripped his Smith & Wesson in both hands and pointed it through his open window frame at the silent Jaguar. "Raise your hands so I can see them," he shouted into the din of the helicopter's engines. "Show your left arm out the window." After a moment, an arm appeared out the driver's window. "Now step out of the car and keep your hands in the air. Lie face down on the pavement." The driver's door opened, and an elegant woman wearing a fashionable dress stepped out. She shielded her face against the sting of the churning sand with one hand and pushed down her billowing skirt with the other. She yelled over the roar of the helicopter, "There must be some mistake. My name is Kathleen Carlson. I'm a lawyer. What's the meaning of this?" Now, 1 hour earlier, the howl of the siren frightened the pigeons off the roof of H Block. The birds rose as one and circled frantically in the California sky above Haywood Private Prison. A voice barked over the loudspeaker. "This is not a drill. Lockdown. I repeat, lockdown." On the exercise yard, the clusters of inmates in orange jumpsuits stared up at the gun tower. Below the rifleman's perch, a sign read, "We don't fire warning shots." The men turned and sullenly trudged back inside, grumbling among themselves. Rows of cell doors clanked shut in a rolling chorus of slamming steel. Once locked in, the inmates erupted into a thunderous clamor of defiance and complaint at the loss of their yard time. In the east wing, a guard ran along an empty cement hallway, breathing hard as he lumbered toward the visitor's room. The thudding of his steel-toed boots echoed off the walls. When he reached the sally port to the visitor's room, he stopped abruptly and stared in alarm. The steel-barred gate was open. The gate was never supposed to be left open. He moved cautiously to the edge of the entrance, then darted a look around the doorway. Inside the small entry room, a black guard sat slumped against the wall, his legs stretched out before him. His head was bowed as if looking down in disbelief at the red stain spreading across his khaki-green shirt. A few feet away, Sergeant Clyde Ratner stood with one boot planted firmly on the neck of a prone inmate who lay motionless on the cement floor. The inmate's face was pressed down into a slowly widening pool of blood. The smell of cordite hung in the air. "Don't stand there," Ratner shouted. "Help Travis." The guard stood rooted to his spot at the gate, staring down in wide-eyed panic. "Johnson, move!" Startled into action, Johnson went to the fallen figure. He knelt down, then he hesitated. He looked up at Ratner, who glared back at him. He turned back and slowly reached out to press two fingers against the black man's neck. After a moment, he rose and stumbled backward with a stunned look on his face, staring down at the stricken guard. "I think he's dead. Oh, my God. Travis is dead." "Johnson, listen to me," Ratner yelled at the frozen guard. "Look at me. Snap out of it. Call for the ambulance and the medical team." Just then, the inmate on the floor breathed out a moan. Small bubbles formed at the corners of his mouth, floated out onto the smooth red pool. "What about him?" the guard asked. Ratner spat. "Take care of Travis."
And that was Ed Rucker reading from the opening of Justice Makes a Killing. When you sat down to write the story, did you have the whole plot worked out ahead of time?
Yeah. In order to, in my view, to craft a engaging legal thriller mystery, you have to have the pieces in place before you sit down to really craft the language. You have to have the clues sparsed out. You have to know the conclusion. I know that some writers just start writing, but I can't do that because I don't know, maybe I don't have enough brain power to do it, but I have to keep a chart to show where a certain fact was revealed along the way, what characters have done this, what characters have done that. So I've got it pretty much almost scene by scene before I really start to write.
So you create the chart ahead of time before you start writing?
Yeah, so that I make sure I don't miss anything or forget to put it in. I don't find it satisfying to have a solution to solve the mystery all of a sudden pop up in the last two pages of the book from nowhere. So it's got to be planned to sort of, when it happens, to have the reader look back and go, "Oh yeah, he did this and he did that, and I didn't spot it, but it's there."
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. As you're writing it, are you the type of writer who will write it very quickly and then go back and edit after the fact, or do you edit as you go?
I edit a lot. I try and have the first draft. I work on it as I don't write quickly. I work on it when I put it down. I write on yellow pads. When I go to type it, I'll edit some then. And once I have the book, I go through it several times, editing, and in fact, speaking out the dialogue out loud so that it sounds the way people really talk.
Oh, that's fair. That's a good tip for writers.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can craft a sentence or a piece of dialogue, but if you actually say it, it sounds to your ear somewhat clumsily. So being able to speak it, I think, at least for me, helps for something to flow so that the reader isn't bounced off the page as it goes along.
Now, one of the kind of legal technicalities that really struck me from this book, from Justice Makes a Killing, had to do with how limited Bobby Earle was in theories that he could put forth. You take the facts and you weave an alternate, you know, the defense story is different from the prosecutor's story, but he had a pretty good story that he wasn't really allowed to tell because of this third party culpability.
Mm-hmm.
Law. Yeah, can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. It's one of the flaws of television depictions is they'll portray a lawyer who, in cross-examining a witness, will sort of spout off a monologue of what he would like the evidence to be, but has no evidence to really support it. Well, weren't you jealous of this, and didn't you go there that night and do this, you know, without anything? So in California and most states, there's a law that says that someone with a motive to do the crime other than the defendant is not enough alone to be able to present that to the jury. You have to have, in addition to motive and opportunity, you have to have some physical connection between that other suspect and the crime itself. And that is where it gets tough. Bobby Earle is faced with great motives from these private prison individuals and the union guards, but without a connection, he can't even bring it up in court. You need to have a witness, you have to have a piece of physical evidence, something other than just a motive and an opportunity. So that is the law. So it's not like on television. And it's one thing that's depicted in the book and explained, and the frustration that comes from that, and how Bobby Earle gets around it.
And I also found it interesting that when one of the witnesses gets killed, he's mm-hmm. not allowed to explain or to tell the jury what
right.
happened.
Right. It that's the relevance standard. In other words, if a witness is unavailable to testify, the prosecution is allowed to read a previous statement from the witness if it was made very close to the events. In other words, if someone said, "Oh my God, they've just been shot. They're lying there. The police come and they say, "Oh my God, my husband shot me," and then they later die. That type of statement can come in. So we have a situation where the guard made a statement of what happened, and then he is killed. Under the laws, the statement comes in, but all the jury is ever told is that the person is not available. And the rationale is that if the reason of the death, particularly one under suspicious circumstances, would allow the jury to speculate about what was happening, who was responsible, and so they just eliminate the possibility of that.
Although it seems like, you know, if witnesses are being knocked off, that might have some bearing on whether the defendant is guilty or not.
Yes, but the jury might also think the defendant is doing it.
But, I guess you're right about that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ed Rucker, author of Justice Makes a Killing. Now, Ed, this is the second legal thriller that you have published. Is there a third one in the works?
Well, I'm thinking of Bobby Earle dealing with a case that he is appointed to be the appellate lawyer, but not to write briefs, but to present new evidence that seems to point to an individual who's been convicted of a murder in 1975, many, many years ago. And it was a interesting time in Los Angeles, around the Manson people, the start of the Chicano movement in Los Angeles with forced sterilization of Hispanic women at the General Hospital. And the oil industry. Most people don't realize that the real attraction of California in the past was not necessarily agricultural jobs, but jobs in the oil industry. At one point in our history, California provided 25% of all the oil in the nation. And currently in Los Angeles, just today, there are 3,000 active oil wells in Los Angeles. So some things that might be interesting to weave into a story.
Yeah. Now, have you ever thought of or actually written about the trials that you participated in?
No, it raises real ethical problems. When a defendant speaks to his lawyer, everything that defendant says is privileged and can't be revealed. Can't be revealed during the case. It can't be revealed many, many years later. Mm-hmm. So to have inside information of a case would run up against that. So no, I haven't. It wouldn't be proper.
Do details from your career make their way into the book in, you know, disguised form?
Well, sure. I mean, I tried over 200 jury trials, and I tried 13 death penalty cases to juries. So you constantly in that type of situation. You see things and you remember things. So the things that happen in the book are very realistic and authentic, which don't have to be presented in a pedantic type of style, because they're interesting just in themselves, just as you brought out how frustrating it is not to be able to bring in what seems like valuable information for the defense because of the laws. You know, it's trials are high drama.
So, Ed, when you set, when you retired and you started writing, did you have a publisher lined up, or how did you find your publisher? And tell us a little bit about how you work with Chickadee Prince Books.
Well, originally I had an agent in New York, but he couldn't place the books with one of the frontline publishers, which is it's not that I have written the great American novel here, but publishing houses now are under economic stress, and they have to be sure if they put the money and resources into publishing a book, it's going to be a big, big seller. So we searched around and found this less lauded publishing house, and they take a chance on first-time authors. So it's been a great great collaboration. So the book now is available at Amazon, any independent bookstore, I hope people take a chance.
And of course, you can probably order it online as well.
Yeah, through Amazon, you can get it. Just put in Ed Rucker or the title.
Although we'd love to support the local bookstores, the independent.
Absolutely,
bookstores.
Yeah. I agree entirely. They're under siege. Yeah, so.
And how long does it take you to write one of these legal thrillers?
Oh, probably a couple years. I start putting it together maybe a year and a half, really. And that's working pretty much full time on it.
Is your writing process, like you, when you're writing a book, you sit down at the desk every day and you work a certain number of hours, or wait to write a certain number of words, or
I found that I end up writing about 4 hours, because after that I start to lose steam. So when I hit that, I just sense that this is it. But I try and leave where I know where I'm going next, so that when I sit down the next day, I'm ready to go. But when I feel like I'm not sharp enough to continue that day, even though I know what I want to tackle next, I'll leave it so that I can do it. And then after the writing, I'll do some typing of the previous day's work. Then when I sit down the next day, I'll go through what I'd written the day before and then pick up where I'd left off.
Okay, because you mentioned that you write on yellow pad, but you don't do the whole thing and then start typing. You type as you go. That's interesting. Do you feel like there's a stronger like mental connection with the pen than if you typed, you know, use the computer keyboard from the beginning?
Yeah, I did a lot of legal writing in my career. I wrote a set of books on California criminal practice. It's in its fourth edition. It's 7 volumes long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I get, I just get in the habit that I don't think I can actually consider anything or think without having a pen in my hand.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
Yeah.
I know the feeling. Well, Ed, we're out of time, and I really want to thank you for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
Well, I enjoyed it very much, Monica. Thank you for the opportunity.
And we always close with a quote. Usually my mom finds the quote, but since she's not here today, I researched one of my favorite people to quote, Mark Twain, and what he has to say about justice. And one of his quotes is, "It is a worthy thing to fight for one's freedom. It is another sight finer to fight for another man's."
Well, that's nice.